Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
I'm Georgie Courage-Cole and welcome to today's In Conversation With podcast. Today I'm joined by a bit of an industry great. I'm joined by Anya Hindmarsh. She is one of the UK's most admired, respected, inspirational and genuinely nice entrepreneurs. And if you haven't read her recent book, If In Doubt, Wash Your Hair, then really you should. As well as that incredible book, she has been awarded an MBE. She is a Greenpeace ambassador. She's had a huge part to play in fashion and sustainability. In fact, she was hugely ahead of her time when she collaborated with Sainsbury's to launch her I'm Not a Plastic Bag campaign. Gosh, there's so much to say. Anya, thank you so much for joining me today. I can't tell you what an inspiration you are and how lovely it is to have you on our podcast. Will you start by giving us a bit of a synopsis to your career? There are a few people I say this to, a national treasure.
And an inspiration really to old.
You've achieved so much. And you know, I know from having read your book how many women you resonate with. My God, that book, I have so much to ask you about that book. But before we get onto that, which is by my bedside, and I'm now on my second read of it, true story, can you give anyone that doesn't know the whole story, can you give us a brief synopsis of, you know, how you are where you are today?
Sure, I can try. My name's Anya Hindmarsh. I'm actually totally British, even though I sound slightly foreign. I'm age 53, which is very old. But I started my business when I was 18. And I think I knew from about the age of 16 that I wanted to work in fashion and that I wanted to work in leather goods. I was fascinated by the subject when I was given a bag when I was about sort of 15, and I remember how it made me feel. And I think the power of the sort of mood changing aspect of fashion is what's always interested me. Plus actually the fact that handbags and leather goods are about organization. And I've always loved the idea of organization, I think partly because when you feel out of control, you like to try and control a little bit. My life sometimes feels quite out of control. So I started designing really immediately. I sort of left school. I went to Florence in Italy, where I knew it was sort of the home of leather, and I wanted to be immersed in it. And I went there really just to, in inverted commas, do a sort of language course for a month. But I knew I just wanted to kind of get into the markets, get into the tanneries and sort of learn on the ground. So I started designing, and I brought some samples of my designs back to London and sold them, first of all, actually to the magazine Harpers and Queen, as it was called then. And it was actually, they had us a monthly offer in the back of the magazine, and we sold 500 bags. And I thought, well, I'm going to keep going and not go to university, which was another possibility. And I started designing more and selling to stores, and then opened my first store, which was actually a first floor store because I couldn't afford a ground floor store. And then opened more stores, and it just grew and grew really through stores and through wholesale and, you know, obviously different collections and different projects along the way.
Can I jump in and ask you about university? You briefly mentioned that was an option and you didn't go. You now have 5 children, and where do you stand on university? And was it a big deal that you didn't go? It's a really fascinating topic, and I certainly don't feel like I will push my children to go down that route and rack up a load of debt for the sake of it. Obviously, it has its place. I read somewhere your parents were both entrepreneurs. Is that right?
Yes. I think, interestingly, it so depends on the child. I mean, to be honest, actually, that was a bit of kind of Billy Big Talk, because I didn't really have many offers for university, so I didn't really even try it, I think. I mean, I was not very academically successful at school. I think probably a bit dyslexic, which is quite classic for most creative people. I don't think I have a bad brain, but I didn't thrive, and I was fairly impatient in the classroom, which I think is probably a sort of a trait of entrepreneurs. Actually, they want to kind of crack on. And I was come from an entrepreneurial sort of family background, so for me that was quite a natural route.
What did your parents do, Anya?
Well, my mum actually taught languages, actually, but with my father, who was the entrepreneur, although very much supported by my mother, who, I mean, I was very much the baby under the in a cot under the desk as my mother was helping my father as he grew his business. So, you know, we very much come from a sort of business background. But I think university can be brilliant if the subject is useful to your career, or it just expands your brain. And of course, it gives you sort of credentials in terms of having sort of the rigor and the discipline of delivering and of a certain sort of, you know, to a certain level of education. So I don't want to diss university, but I do think though that if you know what you want to do, there's an alternative route, which is to kind of get going and to perhaps work, you know, and perhaps you won't be paid that much, but as an intern, as an apprentice, but actually that's effectively better possibly if you know what you want to do, to learn on the job and not rack up the debt. So at least you might not be paid loads, but you're not actually incurring debt. So if there's a route, it's certainly one to consider if you are going to perhaps a more vocational kind of career. So there's no right, no wrong. I always have a bit of a chip on my shoulder about not having had a degree. And I was really pleased when I got an honorary degree, which is so pathetic. But literally, it was just like, okay, now I feel better about myself. So I think it's, you know, it's very much down to the person and what they want to do. And I think often if you don't quite know what you want to do at a young age, actually university is a good thing to do. It stretches your brain. It gives you qualifications. But use those holidays and really explore things that you might want to try.
Yeah, gives you some time to try other things. And what were the qualities? I mean, did you grow up then wanting to have your own business, seeing your father run his business, your mother support him? Did you grow up wanting to do your own thing, or was it just you had this bag and you were fascinated by it? If it was the former, what were the skills that you saw in them that you think filtered through to you that have made you so successful?
Well, I think it was a bit of both, truthfully, in the sense that I was fascinated by this bag and wanted to, that's what I knew I wanted to do. I felt very lucky I knew what I wanted to do. But I also think not only was the background at home one of sort of business and sort of entrepreneurial kind of approach to business, but it was also that time, actually, dare I say, in Thatcher's Britain, where lots of businesses were starting, a lot of red tape was cut. There was, you know, car phone warehouse started, and, you know, I remember Pret a Manger started, and Next was sort of starting direct to, you know, sort of mail order businesses. There was this real sort of momentum of business starting and it being quite an exciting moment. So I think it was, it's when you always have a tent pole, don't you, something sort of happens and it sort of sucks up lots of other people thinking I could do that as well. And I think that momentum is really important to making people believe they can have a go at it as well. So a number of things, I think, really as to why I started. And it's best fun having a business. It's like, I always say, it's a bit like a game of chess every day. You never quite know what's going to happen. And it's super exciting. You're opening your inbox and, you know, there could be a big order or there could be something really interesting. Not always. Sometimes it can just be a total heart sink problem. But, you know, it's a really exciting game. I mean, it's hard work. Don't let anyone kid you anything different. It's really hard work, but you've got to love it. It's got to feel like a really good game every day, and then to be honest, it doesn't really feel like work.
I love that. I still get excitement opening my inbox. I'm glad I'm not the only person. The first product that you launched, can you tell us a bit more about that bag and what it looked like, and what's the closest to it today?
Well, the first bag I ever designed was actually a drawstring duffel bag. So when I went out to Florence, all the Italian girls were wearing these sort of drawstring duffel bags, which I hadn't seen in the UK. And I wanted to kind of recreate something with my sort of take on it that was sort of similar to that style. And so, you know, we have actually a number of bags that have that same. And it is literally a bucket bag with a drawstring. It's not sort of rocket science, but it was quite that was in the.
I see you were way ahead of the curve.
Well, it's funny to think that actually people didn't. There wasn't the cheap travel that there is, rightly or wrongly, now. You know, in the sense you couldn't jump on an EasyJet flight, you know, for £40 to Florence. So it was quite a commitment. So people didn't travel as much, and therefore trends didn't travel as much. It was much more sort of siloed. So it was quite a different time, actually, and so it that felt quite fresh and cool when it sort of came back to London.
And you talked about getting it into the back of Harper's Bazaar. Was that a classified ad or was that editorial? And how did you make that happen if it was the latter?
It was actually an offer they ran. So it wasn't either, really. It was actually sort of something they did as a business model every month. And I approached them because I knew someone who had a stepmother who had a friend. It was, you know, a very tenuous link.
Any link will do. Just
I think as us entrepreneurs work, any link, right? And so I sort of managed to get through to her. I managed to take my suitcase full of bags and And they liked them. And I remember they called down the fashion editor and they decided to run it, which is incredibly trusting. I mean, I was 18 and I, you know, didn't know what an invoice was, frankly. So I just sort of found my way through that and remember managing to get my logo on the samples just before they were sort of photographed, so that, you know, I had sort of essentially I was starting a brand rather than just a product. And that was very much, that was the first break, really.
Amazing. And you sold 500.
Made £7,000 profit. Felt pretty miraculous at the time.
Wow. I was going to say, what was your first I made it moment? I'm thinking it was that.
Well, that, I suppose, was the first sort of time someone took a chance on me. But I remember vividly also getting my first, for me at the time, quite substantial wholesale order. And in those days, a lot of the department stores in America had buying houses based in London to sort of support their sourcing and their buying of different brands. And there was one that was in Golden Square, which represented, I think, Bergdorf Goodman and Henry Bendel and a number of sort of maybe Saks, a number of department stores. And I went to show them my product and came up with this really quite substantial in those days order. And I remember ringing my mum from the red post box, the red phone box in Golden Square, going, I got my first big order. So that was sort of quite exciting as a wholesale order. So, but there's lots of different moments. I always think running a business is a bit like you go from nursery to sort of school and then school to big school. And, you know, there's all those different sort of steps. And there's sort of big moments in each of those different steps.
Have you had any mentors or close advisors? I mean, I always look at you. There's a sort of group of women at your sort of age in the industry who I remember growing up thinking were, you know, women I looked up to. You, Jo Malone, Amanda Wakely. I mean, Chrissy Rucker, and at a similar sort of age, you've all had hugely successful careers. A, are you a cohort? Are you all in touch with each other, supporting each other? And did you have mentors along the way?
So yes, we are all friends. It's a lovely collaborative sort of group of entrepreneurs and people in fashion and women in business, and London's great for that, but I mean also internationally. So it's really lovely. I think people really do support each other, and it's incredibly nice. I think often they think fashion is a sort of bitchy world. I don't find it bitchy at all. I find it incredibly supportive, but also in the wider, you know, Chrissy's a great friend, and in that wider group of people sharing those sort of war stories of growing businesses and the highs and the lows is actually really helpful. I think sticking together and supporting each other, even in different sectors, you tend to have similar challenges and, you know, things you need to kind of work out. So it's very helpful sort of clubbing together. And in terms of mentors, aside from that sort of informal group of, you know, being able to ping out a problem, go help, and someone going, how about talk to that person? Actually, I have to say I've been very lucky with my dad, actually, who's still very much a real supporter and someone I can go to, as you perhaps can a parent, and kind of go at 10 o'clock at night, but there's a real problem, help me. And he'll ring me at 8 in the morning going, I think the answer could be this. And someone you can really lean on, perhaps slightly less now, but he is a brilliant business mind from a completely different sector. But someone I also think it's lovely when you have a sort of a parent or a godparent or someone who perhaps, you know, will give above and beyond because they are aligned and wanting to help you. So I think that that he's also been and still is on my board, which is lovely, aged 81.
Oh,
so
really?
Pretty,
wow.
Pretty damn lucky. Yeah, and as sharp as anything.
Oh, amazing. And on the note of your family, working with your family, being supportive, your husband is he your FD?
He has been FD. In fact, we now have an FD. So his role is, it's really hard to sort of separate, but essentially he does all the bits that I'm not very good at. So it's all the leases and the banks and all those sorts of bits that sort of need a grown-up eye. But we've worked together for nearly 22 years and laugh because obviously it's sort of, you know, we're literally with each other the whole time. I think I'd probably drive him mad. But we're good friends and very much sort of, you know, done all those business journeys and meetings and trips and so on together, along with in a really fantastic team that we work with. But so yeah, we've worked together a long time and very closely.
And do you think, I mean, I have interviewed a lot of entrepreneurs who end up working with their husbands. Do you think it enriches? I mean, a lot of people say, my husband and I joke whether we could or could not work together. And I sometimes think, actually, maybe it's the best thing one could do. Do you think it's really enriched your relationship?
Well, I think it's fantastic in the sense that you're working with someone you completely trust, you're totally aligned in your mission. And I think sometimes, perhaps less so these days, but at the time for me, being a woman and, you know, we've got lots of kids. And so that sort of time when you're trying to navigate that sort of young family stage, which is pretty intense. Having someone there who's, you know, who can share it with you and you can kind of divide and conquer is really helpful. So that's really great.
Do you think it enriches
your relationship? Yeah. I think it actually can be at risk of doing the opposite, actually. I think you have to be quite disciplined to actually make sure, and we don't, by the way, that you kind of separate home from work. I mean, I think sometimes he can kind of go, no, what are you thinking, you know, in front of sort of colleagues. You have to, or I can do the same to him. You have to actually be as respectful with each other as you would a colleague in the work context. Equally, I think it's quite fun, I hope, for the team that, you know, it's very much a family business, I suppose, because of the backdrop of the fact that we're both there. But, you know, sometimes we also often say that much as we are great friends and I think we have a good marriage, you know, it's actually quite nice to go on holiday with friends because I kind of, you know, knew what he had for lunch and he knows what I had for lunch every single day last week. And, you know, it's quite nice to kind of sort of mix it up.
Takes the conversation somewhere else.
Exactly. Lots and lots of benefits. But you have to also be aware that, it, you know, sometimes it can have a different impact as well. And you have to kind of protect that quite carefully.
Yeah, absolutely. You took on outside investors in, when was that, 2006, was it?
About at time, I think so, more or less, yeah.
Well, quite recently, in recent years, bought them out and taken full control again. Can you talk us through that process a little bit? And I mean, I think it's really interesting. I guess the sort of dream, the thing you aim for is potentially to do what you did. It's obviously not always positive. Did you lose control? Are you thrilled to have it back? Can you talk us through that process?
Yeah, so when I started my business, I sort of was self-financed and always sort of grew it carefully and you know, self-financed and profitably. And then we took in actually a while back some investors, in fact, who were friends who approached us saying they wanted to get involved. And that was at a time when we were trying to open more stores and it was useful to have that investment and had a very, very happy and successful 5 years with those friends and investors on board. And then they needed to show an exit after about 5 years. So we brought in some new investors and I actually moved my role at that time from being CEO and creative to being creative. So we brought in external CEO. And then about sort of 5 years later, I realized that actually I quite missed really running the business. I think it's quite hard actually for a founder. And in fact, it was so much sort of, I often chat to fellow founders and saying, I think often rather than bringing in external management, which can be successful and can work very well, but often the more natural thing to do is to bring people up from underneath. So the sort of succession planning is there so that there's a sort of that sense of keeping the same culture and so on. So I felt that I really was missing running the business. And so in 2019, with a partner, we bought the business back and that's been really exciting, actually. So it's interesting, as you grow businesses, people often think that getting investors is a kind of, woohoo, we've got investors, we've made it. But actually investors, to a certain extent, you know, the dream is not to need investors, because actually then you know, if you're an entrepreneur, you don't really like to have to answer to anyone. Yeah. Entrepreneurs tend to be a bit sort of broad brush and don't like doing documents and just kind of act on gut generally. And when you have investors, you have to kind of be a bit more grown up and sort of, you know, set out a plan and, you know, and then you've got to stick to your plan. And it can be quite frustrating, actually, sometimes, although I've been incredibly lucky, actually. So I think that, you know, as long as you can do without investors, you should do without investors. And when you have investors, choose really, really carefully, as I have done, to pick people that you actually kind of want to go on holiday with, because it saves 1,000 words if you're aligned. Because you're all sort of, you know, looking for the same thing. And that makes a huge difference. So it's a long, winding journey. And there's a lot of luck involved as well. But it's when you get it right, it can be really lovely.
But proceed with caution.
Always. It's like getting married. It's an incredibly important decision.
You bought it back. Do you struggle to be motivated ever? I mean, you seem to be as ambitious as ever. You've been at it a long time. I mean, how do you? And it's a question I often ask people, but I, you know, do you worry about hitting the wall ever? Do you worry about waking up and feeling like you can't go another day? Do you have those days? Yeah. How are you motivated to keep going?
I kind of love it, really. I mean, it's really exciting. There's so much that is fun to explore. I mean, you know, fashion per se is obviously an amazing subject, but it's not what gets me out of bed in the morning, actually. What I love is making things that, I mean, I kind of love fashion with purpose, actually. So that might be about organizational pieces. It might be about environmental aspects of fashion and navigating that. I mean, I think fashion to a certain extent is sort of an art form that responds to what's going on in the world. And, you know, there's things happening every day, literally, and the world's changing. We're all realizing, you know, that we've all got to change. And fashion is responding all the time. So I find it incredibly sort of stimulating, really, navigating that with sort of my subject and my sort of platform, if you like, to respond to those sort of challenges that are happening. And so, you know, whether that's, you know, environmental projects that we do, you know, I mean, also these days, it's very much about the kind of community of followers that you have. You know, we have probably about 1 million people that we speak to every week through our various channels. And, you know, we like to talk to them about things that we care about. And it's a two-way conversation. And that might be environmental. It might be, you know, we're just talking about actually zero alcohol drinking and the whole movement about, you know, the fact that my kids drink less than my generation. It's really interesting. And, you know, and actually how does that. So it's more than just a brand. It's actually about, you know, a group of people that you interact with. And so it's very, very interesting. It's changing so much, this industry, this world right now, that I'm never short of ideas. I'm never short of things that I'm excited about, actually. And the day I guess that I'm not, then maybe it's time to stop at that point.
Can we talk a bit more about fashion with purpose? I mean, you were so ahead of your game. I mean, I feel like I'm not going to ask you the plastic bag story, because you've told it so many times, and I mean, we all remember it. And if you don't remember it, then, you know, you read about it. I remember the queues. It was so forward thinking. And I know you've got a new partnership coming up. How have you been so at the forefront and such a visionary in sustainability? Is it something that you always cared about from a young age?
Well, it didn't really feel ahead, to be honest. I think I was just like everyone else at the time. And I think when Al Gore's, you know, documentary came out, and everyone was sort of saying that word environment. And I didn't really know how I could make a difference as an individual or as a business. It was just one of those moments of thinking, actually, I could use fashion as a sort of platform for communication. Because I think the great thing about fashion is it does change people's behavior. It's incredibly viral. You know, that any industry that can make people wear, you know, short skirts 1 minute and long skirts the next, you know, it does really have a big effect on people's behaviors. I think, you know, fashion is feeling, isn't it? It's self-expression, it's confidence. It's so many things that are sort of wrapped up in fashion. And I find it a really interesting sort of subject. And I mean, the environment is really terrifying situation. I think people still are not grasping how incredibly serious this is, because, you know, you only get to see the floods and the fires and the heat waves that are happening all around the world all the time. And if that was happening, you know, every month and on your doorstep, you would change the way you behave. But just because it's perhaps not happening here in London enough that it interrupts their life, it's very easy to carry on. But, you know, we need to I'm probably scared at the moment. So I think using fashion to affect change and to communicate is hopefully useful, but also it's important and I think interesting. So
you can make it sexy, can't you, via fashion? And that's an amazing vehicle to use.
It's a tough subject. It's a scary subject. And, you know, I think if you know the facts, it's quite daunting. A lot of people just almost want to run away and hide and sort of put their fingers in their ears. So it's trying to kind of break it down and sort of say, listen, how about start by doing this? And then, you know, it's recycled materials. It's, you know, it's actually men things. You know, how do you make things that actually couldn't end up in landfill? You know, there's all those subjects which I think break it down into a way that's a bit more palatable and a bit more, probably hopefully have a more successful outcome of changing people's behavior.
And it's so cool. It is, you know, it's so cool to see people like you, people in the industry, get behind sustainability so much. And it's you, whether it's Will.i.am, whether it's Edward Anvil, you know, it's amazing to use that position.
I think we've got to.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Can we talk about the village? You know, you've closed lots of stores. You're very much focusing on digital, and I know that's a result of you regaining control and being as forward thinking as you are, and the pandemic, etc., etc. Yet you've launched the village. Can you tell us about it, the reasoning behind it?
Sure. Well, so we had, I think, the sort of peak, we had about 65 stores across the world. So, you know, Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, LA, New York, you know, all over the world.
Jeez, that is so many stores. It's
a lot of stores, isn't it? I know, Japan.
Yeah.
Really exciting and amazing, but it just is sort of, I feel a sort of magnet back towards sort of local, not global. In some ways, we would sit in meetings and I'd be talking to my London team with a video, you know, filming the meeting for the team in Japan and a video filming the meeting for the team in the States and you know, and Hong Kong and all these different sort of territories. And in some ways, I think that, well, several things. I think cookie cutter stores, the same all over the world, is no longer very exciting. I used to love when I would go to Paris and there's this one little quirky glasses shop that used to make my glasses. And I loved the fact that I could only get them in Paris. And suddenly they were available on every street.
Yeah.
So A, I don't think it feels very modern to have stores everywhere. B, you know, it is without a doubt a digital world. You know, if you can buy it online, you probably will. But I kind of love the idea of going somewhere where you can really experience, you know, that little glasses shop I'm talking about. And so I wanted to go back to where we had our very first store on Pont Street in just off Sloane Street in Chelsea, and to have this little world, which is almost like a sort of, it's five or six stores, including a little cafe, like a little collection of stores with all the things I care about. And I'm there and I was just be there this morning. You know, I'm fiddling with the windows, suppose I'm talking to the team. It's properly, authentically where I am. It's not the store in Singapore that I only visit once a year. And I think that we use it almost like a revolving gallery and concept space. And, you know, it's so we can, if we want to talk about, you know, we've opened, for example, in the village this month, the Dry Drinker, or last month, January, the Dry Drinker, which is a non-alcoholic off license, which is a random subject, but something I think is really interesting, important. And then, you know, we're about to open this really fun color therapy nail bar for Fashion Week in February. And it's just fun projects. You know, we launched our return.
I mean, your part of the Christmas Grotto. I mean, hello, that was just total heaven. My favourite moment was the little boy next to me who asked Father Christmas for a Porsche Taycan for Christmas, which I thought was hilarious.
Scary.
I know. I was like, well, he's got good he might be five, but he's got good taste. Anyway, it was absolute heaven. We totally loved it, as we did your cafe. And yeah, it was wonderful.
Retail, you know, needs to be experienced touch points, things that you can't get online. Otherwise, why would you go? There needs to be a reason to visit. And so I just had this sort of, as I say, magnet to go back to local over global, to make it really authentic, to make it highly creative. Things that, to be honest, were very difficult to do all over the world because they're really complicated and they're one-offs, and it would be kind of impossible to do that and replicate that in 65 stores across the world. So it's really, I really pour all my energy and love and madness into that little village. And I think the lovely thing is we have people coming to visit. They might even go to the cafe first because they've seen it on Instagram, and then they go to the stores, and then they go home, and then they start ordering online. So you end up with the same global distribution, but just in a sort of perhaps a slightly more modern way. So it's really exciting. But more than anything, for me, it's that creative itch. It's sort of my little fairground. It's my little sort of gallery space where I can create what I care about. And I work with a really highly creative, mad band of merry men. And it's sort of where we can, you know, scratch that itch and do those mad things, which often lead to product and lead to interesting things. And I think creatively, often you can't just sort of set out on a we're doing this and box tick and do a business plan. You have to sort of, it has to be iterative. You have to sort of start with one thing and then let it go to another and then be surprised by the outcome and then follow that up. And I think that sort of testing the ignite and that iterative creative process is a real privilege, as opposed to working in a really kind of big corporate place where you've had to sort of spell it out in advance for 6 months and do a business case and defend it in 65 committees. And by the end of it, you've lost any interest in
fully,
it at all.
You can fully go to town, and you obviously have this incredible, incredible attention to detail, which you saw in the grotto, and you see it in the cafe, and you see it in your bags and the organization, and you get it from reading your book. And it obviously allows you to really scratch that itch, but you don't have to roll it out across 60 stores, which must be quite nice. Can you talk to me about some of the product you've created along the way? I really want to come into your book, but I also, just in terms of the sort of evolution of your brand and the products that you've created, what are you most proud of?
It's really hard to pick out sort of favorite children, but there's been some, you know, some projects that have been really fun along the way. And you know, starting with, for example, a project we did which was called Beer Bag, where you could actually make a photograph into a bag, which is an incredibly cheesy idea, which we did for charity, but got such traction, which we've actually just re-brought it out again now, actually, but made out of completely recycled materials. And it was lovely, actually, and lovely. So that was a fun project. Obviously, I am a plastic bag and I'm not a plastic bag, which has been a huge labour of love and a huge amount of R&D, and, you know, making this incredible cotton drill, beautiful fabric, but actually from recycled bottles, but finding that it behaves so much like cotton drill, it would get dirty. So having to find a way to coat it, but managing to extract the plastic that's between the glass and windscreens of cars that would have gone into landfill to coat one side of the fabric. And then other projects, for example, like Return to Nature, which we launched recently, which is about, could you make a bag that could never end up in landfill? So mimicking nature in the sense that, you know, if an apple falls from a tree, it biodegrades and turns into compost to benefit the soil, to make it more nutritious, to support plant life. And so could you make a bag that did that, which we've spent 2 years doing and launched, which was a sort of biodegradable and compostable bag. Really incredibly complicated to do, and you know, working with amazing scientists and farms and learning loads, actually. So many projects. I mean, I think one of my other favorite parts of the business is the area that we call bespoke, which is the idea that it's really more about gifts. The idea you come in and you can have anything embossed with either a handwritten message in your own handwriting or a drawing. And everything comes with your name embossed into it, and the box comes with your name on it. So it's just making presents for life. So things that you would hand down to your great grandchildren. And for me, that's a really lovely idea that, you know, it's not about a season. It's about a moment in time. You know, if a child handwrites their message to their mom or to their grandmother and seals it into the leather, you can't go back and ask a child to write like a 5-year-old again. It's a moment.
Put the letters the wrong way around.
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it? You can't recreate that. So it's just that's a part of the business that is really special to me. In fact, I was in the store this morning, and laughing with the team, and saying, if I die, I'd like my ashes scattered in that store, which I think quite freaked them out, actually. But that's very much at the sort of heart of what we do.
And I think you have got, you know, well, you've got such heart, and that's always, I think, given you such a point of difference in the industry, hasn't it? You've had those personal touches, and you are a mother of so many children, and that's, yeah, all those little personal touches.
They would probably say that I don't have much heart, just FYI, but yes.
Well, I think I have referenced, I don't know how many times this weekend I've referenced the fact that Anya says that, you know, they're supposed to hate us or they're never going to want to leave home. So that's what I keep telling myself. And every friend is like, oh my God, my children. I'm like, don't worry. Anya says it's supposed to be like that. Otherwise, they'll never leave us.
So, I'm never really quite sure if I made that up to make myself feel better, actually.
Well, it's working.
I'm sticking with it anyway.
I mean, your book, why did you write your book? Where did it come from? I mean, it's the best thing I've read in, well, a long time.
Really kind. I do have to say, I felt pretty vulnerable writing the book, if I'm honest. I mean, I have a friend who's an agent, and she was badgering me to write a book, and I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to write about, to be honest. And then I suddenly felt really inspired, actually, by my kids' generation, who are so open about their feelings and so accepting and inclusive. And it just was actually quite breathtaking. In fact, I was talking to someone this morning and saying, isn't it brilliant that you now look at buying swimwear, and when you look at that bikini, you see it on all different sizes and shapes of women. I think the fact is, when you look around in the street, there are all different sizes and shapes of women. I mean, we really are changing, actually mainly driven by that generation. I'm so wowed by them. And I felt it was only fair, in a way, to write my thoughts on life. And it's not a sort of my business journey, or it's just me being really honest about, actually, you know, being a mum, being a stepmom, growing a business, being a woman in business, you know, being a creative, just all the things that I've kind of learnt, borrowed, stolen, that have helped me, and just shoving them all into a book. Things that I talk about if I meet groups of women and sort of say, I've learned this, and oh my God, that's useful. And then I get something from them. So it's a kind of, you know, collated all that sort of stuff, hoping that
it's,
if I hand it
Bible
to someone who's 30, that they get 5 bits from it and kind of go, that really helped me too, thank you. And then they keep adding to it. So it was just quite vulnerable making, because it talks a lot about doubt. And the title, which is If in Doubt, Wash Your Hair, is obviously a kind of jokey title, because I think every woman knows that you sort of feel better somehow, like you can look people in the eye, and if you've kind of looked after yourself, which is sort of silly. But so whilst it's a silly sort of title, it does refer to the fact that we do need to look after ourselves and be a bit kinder to ourselves. Women often are very kind to everyone else and not perhaps kind enough to themselves.
I know, I agree. So I'm always, put your life jacket on first. They tell you for a reason. That's what I spend my life saying to girlfriends.
And also, I think the word doubt in the title is important, because the book is a lot about doubt. It's about the fact that everyone has doubt. Everyone from the prime minister to the, you know, every single person that does anything has doubt. And I think no one's very honest about that. And I think that we need to reframe doubt, to look at it as actually something that can, it's there to help us. You know, it sits on our shoulder like a little gremlin. And it's there going, don't mess up, don't mess up, don't say the wrong thing. But actually, it's protecting us and it's keeping us safe and making us the best version of ourselves. And so you need to kind of control the volume a bit so it's not too high, but actually doubt is a good thing. So I think If in Doubt, Wash Your Hair, it talks about doubt. So that was the reason for the book. It's been pretty scary making. I remember talking to my parents, they went, why are you writing this? And I got all that sort of stuff about yourself. But I thought actually I owed it to that younger generation who've been, I've learned a lot from actually. So I figured I should just kind of tell them from experience, because that's what I can give back, is that, you know, my experience, and explain what I wish I'd known when I was their age that hopefully might be useful.
Well, I'm 41. I'm not their age. And I tell you, I'm bloody grateful that you wrote it, Anya. And
you're really kind.
Laura in my team, I said, could I borrow that, please? And she said, you can, but I've listened to it on Audible and I've now ordered that one because I need to highlight it. And she said, I think I'm going to highlight the whole book. And I'm, this is 100% genuine. It is for anyone listening that hasn't, I mean, I lie in bed reading bits out to my husband to the extent he's at Hunt. Okay, I'm now trying to go to sleep. You're reading bits out about characteristics of an entrepreneur.
That's a really sweet thing to say, because it is, it's quite frightening doing those things. And I really did sort of struggle with doing it. And it's quite a slog writing a book, I will be honest. And so that's really, really sweet. Thank you. That kind of, that sort of nice payback for the weekends and you're kind.
It's that good. It's that good. I mean it, and I can't encourage people to read it more. Can we just talk a little bit about parenting? I mean, you talk about it a lot in the book. It's well known that, my God, you took on three really young children who didn't have a mother, and you've taken them on and they're yours. And it's so heartwarming hearing you talk about them. And it really is. I mean, that's a blended family. I don't think that's talked about enough. I don't think there's enough out there, you know, helping people navigate blending families. You then had two more with your husband. What ages do they span, just to give, if people don't know?
So the youngest is 18 now, and we just finished 28 years of school, so can you imagine? And the oldest is now 32. So so there's a sort of bit of a spread, but it's, I think that the thing I'm honestly proudest of is the fact that it's a family, you know, albeit five from two different mums. You can definitely tell the sort of the older three are all sort of massive academics, which I mean, my two are a bit more sort of dyslexic and creative. it's quite shaming sometimes, even though obviously they're quite brilliant, in case they're listening to this.
My son is dyslexic, and I think it's going to be their superpower. We are, Sherlock's is big on the neurodiversity bandwagon, and I actually think it's going to be fascinating to see how we embrace neurodiversity. And so anyway, I'm sure that'll do brilliantly.
Very more. I actually think there's a book in that actually, and I think that's, yeah, actually where my
there you go, there's your next book.
As a badge of honor, I think I've done my book. But no, it's, listen, I mean, it's the biggest honor, honestly, inheriting children, a huge responsibility, quite terrifying at times, and not always easy for them nor for me. I think they are brilliant. I mean, I'm incredibly lucky to have inherited those three children. And I think modern blended families, it's becoming so normal now that, and I think you're right, there's not enough. Certainly when I took on my three, you know, they're age one, three and four, so very little, and I was 25, I really didn't know what I was doing. But, you know, you do it through love and through honesty and sort of getting advice, but there wasn't that much to read, or there wasn't that much advice out there. I think the lovely thing is it can be really successful, and it takes total honesty, brutal honesty actually, with children, and acceptance and all the sort of things, like, you know, obvious things, but things are very easy to overlook, that, you know, if ever you were to say anything negative about, you know, say, I mean, not that I ever would, obviously, but about their mother, or perhaps in a divorce situation, it's quite easy to imagine that sort of a stepmother might say something negative about their mother. You're actually saying something negative about half of that child. It's so easy to overlook some of those things, which are just so important. So it's you know, it's common sense, but it's respect and it's kindness and it's navigating your way through honesty. And of course, you will mess it up often, but it's also, I think, important and totally doable to sort of say, I got that wrong. I'm really sorry. You know what? I love you to bits and I totally messed that up. And you know, just, it's about, you know, being open and honest. So I sort of tried to write my experience down as best I could, but it really is possible to have a, I mean, I feel so lucky. I'm genuinely lucky to have this group of five kids. And I learned so much. I mean, I am frankly parented by my kids quite a lot of the time. I mean, it's quite interesting, actually. I mean, honestly, I learn from them every day. So it's frankly a privilege.
Have you got them to 18 to 35 with in one piece. I mean,
well, I think they did that themselves, and trust me, some great schools and a whole band of people who've helped me. That's very much been a group effort, and a lot of help from all three sets of grandparents and uncles and aunts. I mean, we've been so damn lucky, because it was a very tragic situation, and so it's been a complete group effort. But they are right now, as of this minute, all in one piece, thank God. And you know, listen, it's a funny old world, isn't it? Trying to navigate five kids as they grow in any situation, but it's a lot of fun.
And for people listening that are running their own business and have young children, I mean, you reference it in your book, and I mean, mine are 4, 9, and 11. So that brings different challenges. But yeah, those early years when there's just no independence at all, what advice would you give to people? Because I think it's also a time when a lot of women decide not to go back to work for various reasons and start their own thing. What advice would you give to entrepreneurs in those early days of their journey, but also juggling who can't do anything for themselves and are totally dependent on you?
My advice is, you just got to get through it. I mean, there's no right, there's no wrong, and there's no one route. And everyone finds their sort of patchwork of childcare, or how you divide the chores and the sort of life admin, and the, which seems to naturally stick to women, but how you divide that with your husband. I think my age group, so I'm sort of 53, as I said, that there's this transition generation that sort of happened, where, you know, I have a memory of my father working very hard and my mother being more of the homemaker. She did work a bit actually, but more of the homemaker, and therefore I have this guilt that I should be as good as my mother. But of course, I can't be working as hard as my father and be as brilliant a homemaker as my mother was and is. And I used to beat myself up quite a lot, you know, if I didn't have beautiful ribbons on every present and didn't do a treasure hunt, but, you know, all the sort of things that she would have done that was so amazing. But the fact is, you know, I'm working my socks off and traveling. And so I've had to readjust and make new traditions and new ways of doing things. And my husband has equally, you know, had to adjust, because he wasn't, you know, his memory is his father sort of coming home and, you know, supper being ready, and he wouldn't have to sort of do any of the children's bath time. And you know, that's just not a reality when we both worked really hard until 7 o'clock. So we've all had to sort of shift. I think I can see in my kids that they are already a bit more 50-50 with their partners. And it's not assumed actually that, you know, just because, you know, if the man and the woman are working as hard, that the woman should pick up all the, you know, getting the ballet kit ready for the class the next morning. You know, why should they write the thank you letter, not the man? So there's a lot of stuff, and I've written about this quite a lot in the book. And so I think once that changes, then actually it won't go back. So I think probably that, you know, my generation, certainly perhaps yours a bit, are still in that adjustment phase. I think it's been quite hard.
Yes, I'm not sure my husband has written a thank you letter since we got married, but I do agree with you. And actually, I think the pandemic's helped, hasn't it? And I think it will be fascinating to see what it's like. I think I look at my children and think, God, I'm fascinated to see what the division of labor will look like.
Yeah, well, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, these things have long tails, I think. But I mean, if you take the thank you letter, which is it's funny because it just makes me laugh at how ridiculous I am. I feel I should write the thank you letter, even though we both went to the dinner, the whatever it was.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Why should I?
I know, because you might be judged that they wrote it and you're a bit,
But why is the husband not judged like that? So it's hilarious that these are things that are set like in stone. And when you look at them afresh, you're like, it's crazy. Why? And if I made my husband write the thank you letter yesterday, I was working, I'm like, you can do the thank you letter. What? Yeah, we both went.
I know. And probably they went, oh, she's so lucky her husband wrote the thank you letter. No one thinks they're lucky if you write it. I know, it's funny, but it's definitely changing, which is fascinating and great. Can we talk a bit more about advice that you'd give to other women wanting to do their own thing? You say it's a wonderful journey and, you know, you wouldn't change it. But for people who are thinking of starting their own thing, what would you say? How would you advise them to get going?
Well, I would say just get going, to be honest. I think you can overthink it. I've sat with lots of people and many children who've sort of, you know, honed their business plans. And the truth is, the moment you start a business, the business plan goes out the window, because you have to respond to you know, the market, essentially, and the endless bottles that are being thrown at you and lobbed at you as you're trying to kind of navigate the direction in which you're trying to reach and go to. So I think just get going, but be very agile, be very sort of dexterous, and be prepared to change. You know, it's great fun starting a business. It really is great fun. I always think there's lots of phases. The first phase is it's super exciting and it's all new and novel, and you've got your new website, your new business cards, and it's all kind of exciting. And then you hit sort of a year in, and actually it gets quite tough. And it might be, it might be 3 years, it might be 3 months, who knows, but, you know, suddenly you've sort of done it a lot, it's not sort of quite going as fast as you want, or, you know, it's hard to get things made because, you know, you might be hitting minimums, or, you know, you're the new person, you won't get the priority in the production, or it may be that people aren't paying you, or, you know, all these sort of, it's what I call the triangle of pain, when it's hard to get the orders and hard to get paid and hard to get things made as well. And you're just in that sort of zone of trying to kind of break through. And at that point, actually, my father gave me some great advice. He said, just don't give up. And I kind of thought about that for a second. I thought, well, that's obvious. He said, no, but if you think about it, if you don't give up, then you won't fail. It was such, such wonderfully
so
obvious
simple.
Advice. Yeah. And it's true. Sometimes just actually sticking at it is kind of the answer. So I think that's the thing. You have to be quite gritty at that point. And so many businesses are lost at that point. Whenever you hit your triangle of pain, and whatever version of triangle it is, it's about sort of leaning in. Lots of businesses give up then, and actually it's a great shame, because, you know, it's so great for the economy to have lots of businesses and lots of, you know, then therefore employers, and I do believe business is the engine of the economy in many ways. And so if you can find a way to navigate that, and that's when it's really good to reach out to people who've got through that stage, to listen to every podcast or every talk, every friend that's been through it, and to sit with them, because it's amazing how you feel re-inspired if you listen to someone else talking about how they hit that brick wall and how they got through it, round it or over it. You know, you've just got to find a way to keep going, and if you do, it's likely that actually you'll go on and you're jumped from that nursery to school to big school to university. You just, there are definite steps, and I often talk about it's like you're swimming in a pool and you're clinging to get on the outside, and you're clinging to the edge, and you finally get on the edge and you sit on the edge, but you spend a long time clinging. Rather ridiculous analogies, but the fact goes in my head. So I think really exciting, and listen, it's tough, because if it wasn't tough, everyone would do it, but I think if you have an idea and you believe in it and you can carry people with you and you can navigate the bottles and you can keep going and not give up at those tough points, you'll get there. You know, it's as simple as that, really. It doesn't sound very simple, does it? But it's fun.
No, I mean, keep going, and yeah, keep going. There you go. What's been the most unexpected success for you? What flew that you didn't think would, or you were worried about?
It's a hard question. Lots of things. You never quite know what's going to fly and what's not going to fly. But I mean, you know, the response to I'm Not a Plastic Bag, which I was excited about, but I remember, you know, to do a collaboration with the supermarket was kind of, you know, unlikely when, you know, brand at our level. And I remember thinking, if it goes wrong, that's really kind of embarrassing. And I remember having people lined up to go and sort of, you know, take the stock away and, you know, save the embarrassment, not knowing what would happen. And you know, the result was 80,000 people queued in one day to buy the bag. It was an absolute ridiculous experience. So you never quite know, in truth, and that's what makes it fun. But when you get something that works, you then have to lean into that and to go with that and not just stick to your plan. And that's what's quite important.
Can you just of your new designs that are out now, what are your favorites?
Well, I love sort of messing with the everyday in a kind of an extraordinary way. So that might be playing with lovely brands. It might be, you know, After Eight, but re-embroidering it in this beautiful sort of way as an evening bag that makes it feel like a little piece of art. And those things you want to keep. I think, you know, we have this lovely range of hand-woven leather bags, which are called the Neeson range.
They are so, that blue you've got, it's like a cornflower blue. It's amazing, yeah.
It's like a leather basket in a way. So it just behaves really lightweight, really sort of soft, and just incredibly, just a beautiful thing actually in terms of craftsmanship. We have a whole range called the labeled range, which is sort of almost every part of your life. So there might be one for makeup, which says makeup, and you open it says brushes. It's almost like a prompt. There might be one for cables and chargers, might be one for your nail varnishes. It's everything all organized, everything has a place and everything in its place, and that just makes me feel sort of better about life somehow. It might just be a beautiful pencil case, and we're all changing the way we're moving right now. You know, we actually brought out a bag called the working from home bag, which is that sort of bag that is essentially your desk. So it has a padded thing for your laptop, and it has a place for your inbox that says inbox, and a place for your outbox, so that, you know, it's almost as you're moving around the house or moving between the office and home or on the train, it just kind of keeps you feeling in control.
Is your house very tidy, Anya?
It's quite tidy, although it's got a lot of children at the moment, so they like to mess with that, which is the constant sort of struggle. But I like to be organized, actually.
I love the idea of a pouch and in the house pouch for those things.
It just makes life easier, honestly. And I think when you're busy, if things are, I think it's quite hard to be creative, actually, if you're disorganized. You know, you end up losing the drawing that matters, and you end up, you know, I used to be embarrassed about being organized. It felt nerdy, and now I'm actually quite proud of it. I think it's important. And so I do like, I'm actually fascinated by organization as a subject. I think they should teach it in school, you know, how to best practice inbox management. You know, what's the most effective to-do list? You know, actually how you process things and have output is fascinating. In fact, we've run courses on this before. We're going to do it again. And I find it super kind of fascinating.
I always remember my sister-in-law saying, you know, don't just tidy your box, shut it down and get on with the thing. You made a similar point, and I thought, yes.
Well, it's, you know, there's definitely the best ways of being productive. And so I found that actually quite interesting. But so, yes, things like that. And so we designed this little bag called the Working From Home Pouch, which is like a sort of pencil case, but it's essentially like the top drawer of your desk. So it has the highlighters, it has the sort of the stapler, it has the sort of cables and chargers that you need. And it's just like, if you grab that, you know what you've got if you're suddenly at your home desk or your office desk. You know, it's just, so I'm a bit nerdy on things like that, but just also beautiful handbags that just make you feel $1 million and make you slightly raise your game, look people in the eye, and you feel the best version of yourself. I don't apologise for that either. Sometimes that's quite important.
Quite. Anya, I've got three final quite quick questions to ask you. First of all, what is in your handbag? So let's forget the keys and the phone and the wallet. I have to say, I've owned several of your patent wallets with the little bows and the tassel. I mean, they have stood me in good stead. They are wonderful. Do you still sell those?
We do. Well, I am obsessed by this idea of a system, so of loose pockets. So like pockets in your bag, but they're not attached. So if you change your bag, you can grab it. So one might be for your first aid, your Nurofen, whatever you might need. One might be for, you know, your pencils and bits for your sort of work. One might be for makeup, you know, one might be for masks currently, and sort of PPE and hand sanitizer. So I just find that, so it's almost like Russian dolls. So you have your bag, but if you're going out to lunch, you can just take the one that's relevant, or you've got it all inside.
Much easier to move bags. Yeah, excellent. I like that a lot. What else is in yours that you no one might know?
God, there's nothing that exciting. I mean, I'm a bit of a sucker for a beautiful sort of leather folio, you know, with all my papers. I like having my papers all organized, so I can have one master one, and inside there's all the kind of current projects that I need to have with me that are printed out, because sometimes paper and pencils. I have a really lovely banana pencil case, which makes me really happy.
Love it. I also have to ask you, how often do you wash your hair?
Pretty much every other day, sometimes every day, but every other day, just because it just makes me feel kind of like I'm ready for the world.
Does the job. And finally, what is next? What's the plan for Anya Hindmarsh? What can you tell us? What's to come?
Well, there's lots come. I'm afraid, sadly, I'd have to kill you if I told you, and I don't want to kill you because you're really nice. But there's lots of projects, lots of plans, and similar themes. But just following our gut really on what we like doing, and it's exciting. I'm kind of really excited actually. There's lots of projects this year, and I'm loving. For me, the village is really fun because I'm really getting to meet customers and people who kind of care about the same things. And actually, it's quite powerful when you get. When you get people together like that, you can do good stuff. So lots of plans, but you'll have to watch this space, I'm afraid.
Well, on the subject of being nice, Anya, you really are. And whoever said that there aren't nice people in the fashion world needs to read your book and think again. Thank you so much. Thank you for that
it
book.
Was a really great pleasure. It's been really fun chatting to you.
Anyway, Anya, thank you so much. Get down to the village. Get your hands on that book. Get some pouches in your life. Your new everything pouches are wonderful. I've loved chatting to you. Thank you so much. Bye-bye. That's it for today. If you enjoyed that, then do please rate, review, subscribe, tell your friends to listen to, and we will be back soon. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.